It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold, in today for Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at a new Supreme Court ruling and what it has to say about executive power.
First, we're getting some advice for kids in middle school, kind of like the advice in this clip from Diary of a Wimpy Kid.
Mom asked me to give you some advice about middle school. It's real simple. Don't talk to anyone. Don't look at anyone. Don't go anywhere. Don't sit down. Don't raise your hand. Don't go to the bathroom. Don't get noticed. Don't choose the wrong locker. Who am I kidding? You'll be dead or homeschooled by the end of the year anyway.
One piece of advice missing from that clip is don't be cool. New research shows that kids who are cool in early adolescence are more likely to have problems with drug and alcohol when they're adults. They're also more likely to have difficulties managing friendships.
Megan Shad is with us to talk about this research. She's one of the co-authors of the study and a graduate student in clinical psychology at the University of Virginia. Megan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, let's start off by talking a little bit about this study. Now, basically, you looked at middle school kids and kind of followed them over time.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
And how did you tell that they were cool or not? Or is there a more clinical term that you used for this?
not exactly. How we figured that out was we looked at some of their different behaviors in early adolescence. And that's really, cool is really our conceptualization. We looked at three different kinds of behaviors, whether or not they were interested or preoccupied in some sense with appearance, like physical attractiveness, and as well as how much they were involved in minor deviant behavior, so things like skipping school or shoplifting things that were like $10 or less. And the third one was how much physical intimacy they had in their romantic relationships between the ages of 13 and 15. And those three things together, we call that last one precocious romantic behavior. We put all three of those behaviors together to determine who the cool kids were. And it turned out that those three things were really related to how much they valued popularity.
Oh, I see. So, and so you surveyed these students. They were determined to be cool, and then you realized that part of the reason they were like that is because they were very focused on being popular?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was part of it. And so we thought that that kind of validated our, were the beginning step to validating our conceptualization of them being cool, and then we moved from there. So we measured things like their actual popularity and things like that.
And so then basically you moved along with them. You sort of followed them along to see how their early coolness in middle school turned out later in life. And you discovered what?
We discovered that essentially they were popular and cool in early adolescence. They got the popularity bump essentially, but then by age 20 to 23, we're seeing some real problems for them.
So some of these remained cool in high school. So it's not like they were found out right when they got in high school and things kind of turned the wrong direction then.
Right. Not right when they got to high school. It becomes the cool kids and the so-called normal kids essentially have the same popularity by about age 16 in our study, at least. And so they get that bump through about the middle of high school, but then it kind of teeters out. We can't tell the difference by the end of high school.
So basically what you're talking about are sort of the early bloomers then in some ways.
Exactly.
You're not necessarily talking about the kids who are cool in high school per se. So those kids in middle school that are really, really ahead of the game, at least in the coolness factor, wind up falling behind later in life.
And that's a really important point, that these behaviors that we're identifying are actually pretty normative for adolescents by about age 16 and 17, but the ones who are displaying these behaviors at age 13, that's the real marker of risk that we're seeing. Those are the kids that are having the problems later in life.
That's interesting. So it's normal for a kid to be concerned about their appearance and stuff like that when they're later in life. That's kind of part of being a teenager, I guess.
Exactly. And it's also associated with this extreme desire to be popular, plus the belief that the way to get there is to act older than you are at the time. So they're doing things that are kind of precocious that not many of their peers are doing. But then, as you're saying, by the time they get to 16, 17, most people are doing the behaviors that we're marking here.
Now, a lot of people, when they find out about your research, they kind of think that the headline is sort of like "Revenge of the Nerds," man. Thank goodness I was in
right.
band when I was in, you know, or whatever. And there's probably more to your research than that, because I mean this actually is sort of a you could potentially offer some advice to the parents of kids who might be at risk of becoming these early bloomer cool kids in middle school that could help them, right? Is that the purpose for the research?
That's definitely one of the directions we'd like to go. One of the things that we like to say is, or to have people hear as a result of our research, is that, you know, if parents are noticing that their middle schoolers might be on this so-called fast track, they shouldn't assume that that's necessarily normal adolescent behavior. As we said, it might be by age 17, but if they're 13, they need to be on the lookout. And also, on the flip side, to reassure the vast majority of parents that if their kid's not on one of these cool kids, that's really okay, and they're probably going to turn out, the long-term effects are going to be really positive.
So it sounds like that sort of middle school phase is really crucial for kids' development then.
Yes. I think our research is starting to show that it really is, and reminding everyone, parents and the kids, that these cool kids may get a lot of airtime on Monday mornings talking about what happened to them over the weekend and what they've been doing. You know, it's really a lot cooler to talk about how they got drunk over the weekend, but it's less cool to talk about watching a movie with a friend at your house. But the kids that are watching the movie and eating ice cream are actually more likely to be in the majority and more likely to do well in the long run. So in a sense, it kind of is the high school reunion effect or the Revenge of the Nerds kind of thing.
We're talking to Megan Shad. She's one of the researchers who wrote that study that you've probably heard about cool middle school kids who aren't so cool later in life or have some challenges later in life. If you have questions for her or you want to talk a little bit about your experience in middle school or ask questions about that, feel free to join the conversation. The lines are open right now, so you can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll be going to calls in just a little bit, but I just wanted to let you know as a listener, if you want to be involved in this conversation, you can join it. Could we talk some more, Megan, about what did you get any sense of what causes kids to be this way when they're 13, as opposed to kids who don't?
Right. That's a very good question. We have certainly some ideas based on what our research and previous research has implied. And what we're thinking at this point, and we would love for future research to continue to bear this out, is that there is an extreme kind of desire to be popular matched with this belief that the way to get there is to act older. So it's almost as if they're pursuing status by impressing others as opposed to connecting with them. And one of the big tasks in adolescence is to learn how to become your own person, but also know how to connect with other people in a meaningful way. And these individuals who are connecting or developing friendships by impressing others and doing these pseudo-mature behaviors, as we're calling them in the paper, are missing out on that developmental step. They're not figuring out how to connect deeply. So they're more focused on appearances as opposed to being good friends.
In doing research for this, sort of leading up to the research with this, were you able to find that there has been any change in that kind of behavior among kids in middle school because of, you know, the rise of digital media and things like that, video game, you know, or...
Yeah. That's a very good question. Part of our larger study, there are some researchers in our group who are looking at social media. I have not done that, but it's certainly an avenue we're looking into, and I'm because that's not my area, I'm not quite familiar with any research that would indicate that. But that's just because I'm not as familiar with that body of research.
Well, we're going to continue this conversation in just a minute. We're talking to Megan Shad from the University of Virginia about some new research that the kids who were cool in middle school were more likely to struggle as young adults. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Megan Shad from the University of Virginia about new research showing that kids who are cool in middle school struggle more as young adults.
And we're taking your calls now. Are you surprised to hear about this research? Does it ring true with what you experienced in middle school? Or do you want to challenge the research a little bit? We'd like to hear from you. We'd like you to join the conversation. If you have questions or comments, call in and let us know at 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@WPR.org or post on the Central Time Facebook page. It's a great chance to talk to Megan Shad, who was one of the authors of the University of Virginia research showing that kids who are cool in middle school struggle more as young adults. And let's go to the phones here. Phil from Racine. Phil, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, I guess I'm not very surprised by your research finding, because it seems as though the endpoints that you're looking at are really more, instead of measuring coolness, are really measuring rebellion.
Okay, Phil, that's a good comment. Megan, you want to respond to that?
In some ways, that is true in terms of our behaviors like skipping school or shoplifting and things like that. I'm not sure how rebellious, though, valuing appearances or getting romantically involved would be considered. All of those behaviors are considered normative for adolescents in general, which is, you know, could be considered a rebellious time overall, which we would conceptualize as part of their way of figuring out how to be independent from their parents.
And Megan, did you also ask other students, their sort of colleagues or whatever at school, whether they thought they were cool? Did you do that? Or
I did. Well, the researchers did, not me personally.
Right.
But yes, in fact, they were popular. So we asked all of the entire grade to nominate who they wanted to spend Saturday nights with. And these individuals, it was associated, the ones who were doing these pseudo-mature behaviors, as we're calling them, had higher levels of, or higher nominations of, this popularity.
And the thing that's really odd about it, and I'll just bring this up and we'll move on, but it's really funny because your definition of the cool kid kind of sounds like a Ferris Bueller from the movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We weren't really trying to define the super rebellious, you know, rebel without a cause kind of
sort of
person,
sulking just James Dean type. It's actually more
right.
of the likable.
Exactly. The one who's trying to please his peers, trying to be doing the things that his older peers are already doing, because it's normative for them to be doing it at 16 and 17, but they just happen to be doing it at 13 and 14.
All right. Well, let's go to the phones. We have lots of people on the line. 800-642-1234 is the number. Jim from Kenosha, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks.
So, what?
Hello. Yeah. Well, I was a cool kid when I was a kid. Now I'm an old man, and I gotta agree that a lot of my buddies really, you know, didn't quite fare so well. I feel like I'm kind of one of the lucky ones, you know, that I not only did okay, but actually thrived. You might say I'm a success, you know, materially.
So were you cool in middle school, or did you become cool in high school?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you were cool, like, from the very beginning.
Yeah, I was cool in middle school. I was cool in sixth grade.
Wow.
And by middle school, I was very cool.
So does this research make you mad?
I was the coolest. No, it's kind of interesting. That's the reason why I called.
And it kind of rings true for you because you had other cool friends who didn't turn out as well as you did.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that call, Jim. And Megan, I guess Jim's example, you actually discovered that in some of your research, too. There were some cool people who turned out okay, like Jim.
Yes, definitely. So it is important to also for everyone to know that this isn't necessarily a life sentence, or if parents are concerned about their kids being on this fast track, it doesn't necessarily mean these outcomes that we're finding are going to happen to them. You know, all of our research is based on what correlations, or what I mean is only some of the people who are even in this group are experiencing these negative outcomes. And it's a significant portion, so we're really concerned about this group in general, but not everyone in the group is going to have these outcomes.
All right. Well, we're going to go back to the phones again. Stephen from La Crosse. Stephen, welcome to Central Time. Stephen, I think you have your phone up or something. Stephen, can you hear me? I think we lost Stephen. So let's move on to Marcus from Appleton. Marcus, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
What's your comment?
Can you hear me?
Yep, I can hear you just fine.
Excellent. I was actually wondering what your guests would say to adults such as myself. I'm at an age now where I'm not considering having children yet, but I'm considering whether I'd want to have children. And I can think of just as many reasons why it might not be a good idea these days as it would be to actually have children. And this is one of the very issues that I consider is the kind of life that my child might have when they're in school. Are they going to be the popular kid that ends up failing as adults, or are they going to be the not popular kid that ends up suffering while they're going through school? And I often consider maybe not having kids is the better choice.
Well, Marcus, thanks for that call. Would you feel that way, having worked on this research for years, Megan, that you're kind of darned if you do and darned if you don't in terms of coolness?
Right. It's a good question and a really hard question to answer. Just based on the research, there's a ton of positive research about adolescents moving through all of school and all of adolescence in terms of their social, like, friendships and romantic relationships really, really successfully. And, you know, just to highlight again, this particular research would also support that if we looked at the opposite of the findings. So the majority of students are not in the cool crowd. They're in the just normal crowd, and they have great experiences. So even the opposite extreme that the caller was talking about, with the ones who really struggle and have a terrible experience in school, that's also the minority. So the majority of people just sort of float through, and kind of nobody notices them except their small group of friends. And they have good experiences, and they do learn to connect with others successfully, and they have, but, you know.
Did you get any sense from your research that kids that aren't cool actually may benefit from that, because it's part of their development is people and moving into young adulthood?
In terms of the way we conceptualize it in this paper, that could be one of the interpretations of this data. Yeah, definitely. But I can't say that as a global statement, but in terms of the behaviors that we're conceptualizing as cool here, that's certainly something we could at least say for some students.
All right, well, let's go to the phones again. Stephen from La Crosse. Stephen, I hope you're there this time.
Yes, I am.
Great. Well, thanks for calling. What's your comment?
Yes, my question for Megan is, so I graduated from high school about 4 years ago. And I was friends with a kid all the way through in the middle school. Particularly, I remember he was I guess he had more friends than the average person, so he was a very popular person. And like recently, I've seen him kind of fall by the wayside and maybe kind of fit this group of people that you're kind of looking for in your research. And my question for you is, he's a dear friend of mine, and what do you think? What kind of hope is there for people like him who have kind of just fallen to the slumps and kind of just kind of been, you know, that kind of person, like, as of lately? And maybe how can we change their attitudes to help them improve their life, I guess?
Well, Stephen, thanks for that question. Megan, Chad, do you have some comments on that?
Well, I can certainly try and answer. It does sound like a sad story for your friend, and I'm glad that you're interested in helping him. The research that we've done wouldn't have much to say about that, because we were more interested in the mechanisms in adolescence and how, you know, people can intervene in the early stages. But you can certainly do things like support your friend, be there for him. You know, what our paper says is that, or what one of the implications is that we think these individuals have a hard time connecting to other people because they're relying so much on these behaviors that are impressing others as opposed to connecting with others. And so if perhaps, and I'm speculating here, but perhaps your friend might benefit from learning how to connect and just be having some supportive friendships for him as an early adult.
Well, Stephen, thanks for that call. We'll have to wrap things up on that. Megan, Shad, what do you think is next? I mean, I'm guessing that this will drive you to do more research. What will you do?
Most definitely. This is some of our very exciting research. We're very, very interested in it. And perhaps we will look at the early adult outcomes and what can be done in early adulthood for these individuals who this has already happened to.
Well, thank you so much. Megan Shad is from the University of Virginia. She worked on some new research. And you're listening to Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, if you love donuts, and who doesn't, I ask, we learn how to make them at home in this week's installment of Food Friday.
But first, this week, the Supreme Court struck down three of President Obama's recess appointments to the National Labor Relations Board, saying he had overreached by trying to fill the appointments while the Senate was on a brief break.
The ruling comes at a time of partisan gridlock on Capitol Hill, and it was hailed by Republicans who said that they saw the president's move as an abuse of executive power.
Well, what does the ruling mean for presidential powers moving forward? With us now is Josh Gerstein, senior White House reporter for Politico. Josh, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, good to be with you.
So this week, the Supreme Court checked the president's executive powers when it comes to recess appointments. What did they decide?
Well, the court ruled 9-0, actually, unanimously, that these appointments that President Obama issued, as you mentioned, to the National Labor Relations Board in January of 2012, were unconstitutional. The consensus on the court was that the Senate was basically not in a recess. The president used this power called recess appointment, and it's in the Constitution that when the Senate is in recess, the president can fill certain vacancies in the executive branch and also the judicial branch. But the Supreme Court said that the three-day recess that the Senate was in just wasn't long enough to count for the purposes of the Constitution. The Senate was basically in a vacation break that lasted a few weeks, but was doing something called pro forma sessions, where every few days, one, two, three, a few members of the Senate would come in and basically open the session and close it rather quickly, basically in a mechanism that's used to try to prevent just this thing, just these types of recess appointments. So it was a pretty big defeat for the White House. The court did divide 5-4 on some questions relating to recess appointments. So it wasn't as big of a loss for the White House or as big of a disappointment for those who are arguing in favor of a broader recess appointment power as it could be. But I still think as a practical matter, in the wake of this ruling, it's going to be fairly easy for the Senate to thwart the president from making basically any recess appointments in the future if the Senate's so inclined to do that.
Yeah, the White House was sort of billing this as a good news, bad news sort of scenario. You're saying it's maybe more bad news. Can you give us a sense of why the president was going that route to begin with?
Well, I mean, the reason the president felt that he would consider doing these recess appointments was because of gridlock in the Senate. Now, that brings up something that has changed here. There's been a pretty significant change in the political landscape since this dispute arose two and a half years ago, which is just last fall, the Democrats in the Senate exercised the so-called nuclear option, and that basically expressing frustration with Republicans for holding up both judicial and executive branch nominees. The Democrats changed the Senate rules to require only 50 votes to approve a nomination instead of what was effectively a 60-vote requirement or hurdle before that. That meant that Republicans were no longer needed under the current breakdown of the Senate to get the president's nominees through. So in a sense, this recess appointment case isn't as significant now as it was when it started. It could potentially be a little more significant in the future if the Republicans were to take control of the Senate or if you had a very, very closely divided Senate. But even if the Republicans take control, I'm not sure that this opinion would be that critical. In fact, its primary impact right now might be to provide some political support for Republicans who are complaining that the president sometimes goes too far in exercising his executive powers.
Now, the court was considering stricter rules on these recess appointments that would have made it, you know, even more difficult. Can you tell us a bit about what else was on the table under consideration?
Yeah, so these are pretty technical, but a lower court, the D.C. Circuit, had found that the president's recess appointments were unconstitutional for three separate reasons. One was because, as I mentioned, that it was only a three-day break, and the Senate said it wasn't really in recess. But there were two other reasons. One, the court said that this power only applied to vacancies that occurred during a specific recess. So that would mean if a slot had been open for months or even years, the president couldn't fill it during a recess. He could only fill one that just occurred. You know, if someone died in office or abruptly resigned, the president could move to fill that slot. But any long-term vacancies, he couldn't, and that would obviously be a big problem from a presidential point of view. And so that was one concern. And then the other one was a question of maybe this power applies only during breaks between what's typically the two sessions of the Senate. That could be as much as a year apart. Again, if you took that view, it would really dramatically constrain the president's power. But as I say, I think just by saying that whenever the Senate goes out for 10 days or less, it's not really in recess, the Supreme Court has sort of handed the Senate a way to block future recess appointments. It should also be noted that it's not totally up to the Senate whether it goes into recess. Some people may wonder, well, if it's Democratic controlled, why don't they just go into recess and let the president make some of these nominations? But it turns out that the way the Senate does that as a legal matter and according to legislative rules, it actually needs the consent of the House. And so if the House is controlled by Republicans, they can actually contribute to blocking these kinds of recess appointments as well.
Now, some of the reasons that the court didn't go the stricter route, some of the three you just mentioned there, reasons given were the centuries of history and the traditional practice of presidents in the past that the court didn't want to upset, Justice Breyer in particular referring to that. Can you give us a sense of the history that Breyer was referring to?
Well, you know, Breyer is really, I call him sort of an institutionalist. You know, he thinks that the government's long-established traditions should generally be respected unless there's some significant reason to go another way. And he's very reluctant to say that something that's been going on for 200 years in a certain way is actually in violation of the Constitution, which is what the conservative judges on the justices on the Supreme Court concluded. Breyer, writing for the liberals as well as Justice Kennedy, said that in this case there was a history of appointments for decades, if not for centuries, where presidents had filled up various nominations, probably hundreds of them in both the judicial branch and the executive branch during recesses. And most of the time, presidents didn't think that it had to be between a session or that the break had to be officially declared as a recess or anything along those lines. So he felt that allowing presidents to retain that power was in keeping with the traditions. But you need to keep in mind that when the Constitution was written, the recesses, people were probably thinking that Congress would be out of session more often than in session, and that there might be months between congressional sessions, because you're talking about people coming by horseback to the Capitol, and it was just a totally different situation from the modern era when, you know, Congress can be called back into session probably on a day's notice if that's necessary.
And there's been this tug of war going on recently between Congress and the president over the use of executive powers. How does this tip the scales?
Well, this does provide one more talking point, one more arrow in the quiver, if you will, for the GOP argument that the president is going too far in wielding his executive power. You know, just a few days ago, we had House Speaker John Boehner come out and say that he planned to file a lawsuit against the president for him overstepping his bounds in various issues, including immigration, including Obamacare, both areas where the president has claimed some unusual, if not unprecedented, authority to ignore aspects of the law or to not enforce certain aspects of the law. That has angered many Republicans. They've been complaining about it for months, and we've seen similar complaints in other spheres. For example, the deal between the Taliban and the Obama administration to turn over five Taliban prisoners in exchange for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl out of Afghanistan. Congress wasn't notified there as required by law. The president said, given the urgency of the matter, he didn't really have to notify Congress, or he wasn't going to. And even the NSA issue, I think, has put some legislators in both parties on edge about what they see as sort of uncontrolled, unbridled executive power. It's an interesting complaint for people to be leveling at President Obama, of course, because, you know, he came to office in 2007 and 2008, in many respects, very critical of then-President George W. Bush's use of executive power on a variety of fronts. And now we see President Obama using many of those same powers as he finds himself sort of frustrated with Congress on some of the issues he's concerned about.
And as you mentioned before, the recess appointments had been used by the White House as a way to cut through some of the gridlock. What does this mean for both the Obama White House and future presidents about how to work within that framework that seems so prevalent these days, gridlock?
Well, you know, it means that the president is not going to have as much leverage as he used to in these situations, although we should again take note that if the Senate keeps its 50-vote rule instead of its 60-vote rule, the president still has a pretty wide amount of latitude to try to get those 50 votes. It's probably, again, going to come into play most often when the Senate has fallen into opposition hands, the opposite of the party that's in the White House, and when there are enough senators there that will resist almost anybody the president nominates. That's the kind of resistance we've been seeing, maybe not on every executive branch nomination, but on a lot of judicial nominations we've seen Republicans take sort of a party line approach. And so I think, you know, the president may in some cases have to, in the future, this president or another president might have to nominate some people that are less controversial, that are more moderate, more middle of the road than he or she might be inclined to nominate otherwise, just in order to try to get those people through the Senate. And they won't have this sort of relief valve, if you will, of being able to stick somebody in through a recess appointment, because I think that's probably effectively that door's going to be closed.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Josh, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We've been speaking to Josh Gerstein, senior White House correspondent for Politico. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. It may seem odd talking about donuts in the summer, but you may be surprised to hear that the fried, tasty treats are popular in all climates, and donuts have quite a history.
President Kennedy once accidentally called himself a donut on a visit to Berlin, and donuts played a vital role in both world wars.
Donuts are also international. There are many delicious variations of the treat. Today on Food Friday, we'll learn more about the donut and how you can make them at home.
With us is Michael Crondell, a food writer, culinary historian, cooking teacher, and artist. He's the author of the book, The Donut: History, Recipes, and Lore from Boston to Berlin. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So the donut sort of seems like this treat for everybody, but it's got this history stretching back thousands of years. Can you tell us when the donut first made its debut?
Well, you know, at some point people figured out that if you fried a hunk of dough that it was tastier than if you baked it, and that probably happened a really long time ago. The ancient Greeks had some sort of fried dough. Certainly the medieval Europeans would celebrate all sorts of occasions by frying dough. It was really only in America that it became kind of an everyday treat rather than a special occasion treat.
So what kind of special occasions did people use donuts for?
Mostly carnival, because to make donuts, you need, especially in European-style donuts, like, you know, jelly donuts type of thing, you need lots of lard. And so after the winter, you'd have all these slaughtered pigs, you'd have all this lard, and then you would have carnival. And what do you do with all that lard? Well, you make donuts, because during carnival, you can't eat the lard for...
So basically, the weather gets warm, people go wild, and they have donuts.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Well, they would, you know, they would cross-dress, they would do all sorts of illicit activities, and they would eat donuts.
Is that why beignets are popular in New Orleans?
It may be one reason. Yeah. Or I think just in New Orleans, they know what they're doing.
but donuts aren't just all about going crazy and indulgence, too. There's some situations where it's not sinful. It's actually a religious element, right?
That's right. I mean, Hanukkah is traditionally celebrated with donuts. In many Arab and Muslim cultures, during Ramadan, you begin the evening meal, or you sort of end the day's fast by eating some fried dough. So, yeah, there's this long religious association. I mean, the funny thing is that, you know, when they came to the United States, they became ordinary. It was in Europe, they had been special occasion treats. There is a medieval poem that talks about a land of plenty where the fences are made with bratwurst and the trees are hung with donuts. And you know,
that sounds like Wisconsin, actually.
It's like Wisconsin.
If you add cheese, yeah, that is Wisconsin.
Right, all you need to do. So in America, this was the real deal. This is what they came for. They came for a land, you know, where the fences were made with bratwurst and the trees hung with donuts.
Are there places in the world, Michael, where people love donuts as much as we love them in America, or is it something that Americans, you know, we have just a special place in our hearts for donuts?
I think we have a special place for excess. You know, lots of countries eat donuts. The Viennese are particularly fond of their donuts. Italians are fond of their donuts. But I don't think anybody has originated, you know, these, well, I know, nobody's originated these massive donut chains, with the one exception being Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Canadians are even more obsessed with donuts, and it may be because the weather in much of Canada is much like it is in Wisconsin.
You know, coffee and donuts go together, that kind of thing?
Sure, and on a cold winter's day, or, you know, even on a summer day, who could turn out a fresh donut?
Well, one interesting fact about donuts, you say that it was donuts and not burgers that actually started the whole fast food revolution.
Well, they did, because if you look back into the 1920s and the 30s, there weren't fast food burger joints, but there were fast food donut stores that opened up. There was a company based in New York, which eventually turned into the Donut Corporation of America, and set up a Mayflower chain of donut shops. And then later you had Krispy Kreme, which originates in the 1930s, long before there was, you know, McDonald's or anything like that.
And Mr. Donut?
Sure, Mr. Donut. Well, Mr. Donut was actually a spinoff of Dunkin' Donuts.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The original owner of Dunkin' Donuts had a partner, and they split up at one point, and one ran with the Mr. Donut name.
Wow.
Well, let's talk about how you make donuts, because, you know, you don't have to buy them. You can make them at home. Real quickly, how do you sort of, what's the baseline of making a good donut?
The baseline is having some fat to fry in. Donuts are not difficult to make, but you want to make them for a crowd. You don't want to, you can't make two donuts. So if you're going to make a batch of donuts, make a dozen, make two dozen. Because once you've got the setup, it's easy enough. But getting the setup ready and, you know, dealing with the oil and all that takes a little bit of effort.
So what fat is best to use?
You want a heavy pot. You want to put in about 2 inches of oil, or possibly something like vegetable shortening. Or if you want to be really authentic, get yourself some lard.
But only 2 inches. I when I was a kid, we used to make donuts, and we had like a whole...
Like a fry daddy.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can get away with 2 inches. 3 inches, 4 inches is better.
Wow, well, that makes it easier, though.
Yeah, 2 inches you can get away with, particularly if you make kind of, you know, traditional kind of ring-style donuts. They don't blow up that much.
And then what kind of flour are you using with this?
The flour?
Yeah.
Oh, just regular all-purpose flour mostly. Occasionally cake flour. If you're making cake donuts, cake flour will give you a slightly... more cakey, crumbly, tender consistency. But if you're going to make a yeast donut, you know the difference between a cake donut and a yeast donut, right?
Well, tell me.
Okay.
So, I know it, but like a cake donut is basically like a cake. Yeast is like bread.
Right, exactly. So one has this kind of pulley texture, sort of like a Krispy Kreme typically, right? And the other kind has a crumbly texture, more like a Dunkin' Donuts type donut.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some people like one and some people like the other. The advantage of the cake donut is you can vary the flavors a lot more. The advantage of the yeast donut is it's less greasy. It doesn't absorb as much fat.
And we got to talk about the recipe that you shared with us, one called Nutella Bomboloncini.
Oh, those are so good.
What are those? Can you walk us through the recipe?
Those are a yeast donut. Those are basically a Boston cream, if you want to call it that, or a jelly donut. Except instead of filling them with jelly, you take a piping bag and you insert into the middle and you just fill it with Nutella until it starts oozing at the top.
That can't be bad.
No, they're like crazy good.
And you can do that as a donut hole as well?
You can, if you really want to be abstemious.
And we do have that recipe on the Central Time Facebook page. And I got to say, I have never made donuts. Apparently, Mike has made donuts. They always seem intimidating. Are they hard to make? You mentioned, you know, a couple inches
of fat.
They're
not that bad. I mean, you need a thermometer so you know how hot the fat is. And they're no harder than making a cupcake, really.
And we used to make them with, you know, that poppin' fresh dough. Yeah, we'd take the dough and we'd make it donut shaped and we'd fry it.
You know what's funny about that? There's somebody out there trying to sell a biscuit donut. You know the cronut phase.
Yeah, phase,
right? So now they're all trying to come up with new crazes or new kind of recipes that are based on the donut. And apparently, there's somebody coming out with a biscuit donut, which is very much what you're describing, right?
Oh, sounds so yummy. Michael, thank you for coming on and talking donuts today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
We've been talking to Michael Crondell, food writer, culinary historian, cooking teacher, and artist. He's the author of The Donut, History, Recipes, and Lore from Boston to Berlin. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back.